tonight. Sunset 8:14, more rain with a low of 45. Thursday, cloudy and mild, a 30% chance of rain. Tomorrow's high 57. Then we start to dry out for Friday through the Memorial Day weekend. The current numbers right now, it is light rain around the area, 48 degrees in Kenosha, 46 this morning in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Very happy to be sitting opposite Dr. Art Sear, a frequent guest to the Morning Show for more than 20 years on a monthly basis. He has joined us to offer his sage commentary on a variety of current issues and events. And we have several different interesting topics that we can touch on today that he has explored in his nationally syndicated column. He is also responsible for the book After the Cold War. And Professor Sear has written recently in his columns on matters such as President Trump's recent trip to the Middle East, elections in our neighbor to the north, Canada, and offered some really moving thoughts about our most recent Pope, Pope Francis. And we will not only talk about Pope Francis, but probably spend a bit of time talking about Pope Leo, who, of course, is our not only our newest pope, but also the first American pope in history. So there are a lot of interesting things to be talking about. And Professor Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much, Craig. You're always so gracious.
Always glad to have you here.
And, yes, always so warm on a cold, wet morning.
Yeah, thank you for making your way through the worst that Mother Nature is throwing at us at the moment. Let's talk for a moment about the elections in Canada. And I do think this is something that sort of slipped past at least some Americans, or certainly I think plenty of us Americans, while we might have known about an important election in Canada, might not have really understood the significance of it. The election, which took place back on April 28th, a victory for the Liberals.
Yes.
Explain, first of all, the kind of put this in context and to what extent this marks some sort of fairly dramatic reversal in terms of the political climate in Canada.
Well, it certainly was a reversal of the political fortunes of the parties. They have more than two, but the Liberals are a particularly strong and durable party. I'm not an expert on Canadian politics, but I think every U.S. person has an obligation to look north of the border, especially nowadays, and try to understand reality as opposed to certain rhetoric that's prominent. To actually answer your question, the Liberals were far behind. Nationalist Party, led by a man who is a declared admirer of Donald Trump, and he tried to kind of pattern his political appeal on Trump, which turned out the cultures really were geographically close, but the two cultures are really quite different. Mm-hmm. And that provided an opening for the Liberals, especially after President Trump started making Canada a big issue in the 2024 campaign. I recall the president talking about NAFTA and making changes, which turned out to be modernizing NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, in 2016. But this kind of bizarre talk about possibly annexing Canada, and there's a very long and discouraging history from early in the United States on that score. So that provided the Liberals a chance to win. They picked Mark Carney as their leader, I think, as part of the, once they saw blue sky politically. Fairly recently, he has been chosen. He's obviously a very politically attuned and astute man, but his background is more in civil service and in public service. He was head of the Bank of England and did a universally applauded job during the financial crisis of 2007, 8, and 9, and for that reason became head of the Bank of England, which I believe is historically unprecedented.
Wow.
The Bank of England punches above the weight of the British economy, you might say, because Britain is such a still extremely important magnet for finance, and starting with Margaret Thatcher, a relatively strong magnet for foreign investment, and because not just banking and shipping services, but financial services generally. Insurance is, I believe, the historic foundation, apart from traditional banking and the stock market. But because financial services generally are so important to the world, and London has become remains such a center in that regard, it's very, very significant. And that really put Mr. Carney on the world stage. He has the prudence of a diplomat and a banker, and some contrast to some other politicians. And I think the Liberals picked him for that style. Also a very competent executive, which in my extremely limited experience is quite unusual in politics.
Hmm. Especially nowadays. And you say that Mr. Carney kind of with his temperament that you just described,
yeah,
reflects the tradition of calm in a crisis that we've, yeah, often seen,
right,
in our neighbors to the north. One of my favorite moments in this column where you kind of sketch for us the length and depth and breadth of the connection between our two nations is when you quote John F. Kennedy in some kind of a speech that he gave back during his term, when he said at one point, speaking about the U.S. and Canada,
yes,
geography has made us neighbors, history has made us friends, economics has made us partners, and necessity has made us allies. And
great line.
Yeah, it really is. And among other things, it really underscores the complexity of, for instance, our relationship with the United States. I mean, it's very easy to oversimplify it as just, well, yeah, they're our neighbors to the north. That's why we're close with Canada. But there's much more than just geographic proximity that connects us.
Yes, indeed, as the president very nicely summed up. President Kennedy had an aide who was also something of an alter ego, at least in professional terms, Ted Sorensen, a talented speechwriter, and it's generally acknowledged that he had a lot to do with the very good published material under President Kennedy's name, starting when he was actually a student, but during his political career, Sorensen helped him with major addresses and a whole slew of speeches with the candidates, and also a couple of books, Profiles in Courage, which is quite well known and won the Pulitzer Prize in the late 50s, with some help from Kennedy's very influential father, Joe Kennedy, and also A Nation of Immigrants, which is not well known at all, but given the focus of American politics on immigration in some rather nasty and ugly ways, in my opinion. Kennedy's book, A Nation of Immigrants, is actually great history, and it's more than just a speech. Mm. As with Profiles in Courage, it's a lot of historical detail about the nature of the immigrant experience and the central role of immigration in the United States.
A timely book, yeah.
And the acknowledgement of that by the Founding Fathers.
I wanted to give you a chance to tell our listeners about a story that, I mean, for all that I've followed in President Kennedy's term, I never heard this intriguing story about a certain briefcase that was left behind along with a memo that,
yeah,
angered very much that the present-day Prime Minister of Canada. This is a fascinating little story, and I think it'd be safe to call this incident kind of a bump in the otherwise generally positive relations between the U.S. and Canada. I'll let you tell this story to our listeners.
Yes, generally positive relationships, but in the early 60s, John Diefenbaker was Prime Minister of Canada, an extremely volatile, emotional man, rather un-Canadian in a way. He rode a wave of nationalist sentiment at the time, and became prime minister. He's sort of a north of the border version of Donald Trump. He expressed great hostility and irritation with foreigners and foreign practices. He was quite critical of the United States, very atypical of Canadian prime ministers. And he was kind of irrational, in his case at least. It politically did not pay off for him over the long term. I think it's fair to say he and JFK did not exactly hit it off, especially privately. McGeorge Bundy, the president's national security advisor, a job that's been in the news lately because of the turmoil in the Trump administration, wrote the president a briefing memo, standard practice, so the boss gets some good background before going north. And Bundy had a reputation for being a superb briefer and a superb memo writer. And he and another case where he and the president were in sync in professional terms. So the president had scrawled at the bottom of this memo from Mac Bundy, "Mac, so how do I deal with this SOB? And Bundy left the memo behind, I think, as you say, in a briefcase in his hotel room when the presidential party left the country. And it was discovered and examined, and the memo was brought to Diefenbaker, who had an unholy fit and was burning up the phone wires in those days, complaining to the White House and saying, "I'm going to go public with this. I'm going to go. I don't know what I'm going to do, but this is really outrageous and really terrible, and you'd better make amends to me." And President Kennedy responded that he wanted to apologize for his poor penmanship. He had not written SOB. He'd actually written OAS, a reference to the Organization of American States, which was a nice way of deflecting the matter. Then went out of his way. He had what became highly popular, televised for the first time at the presidential level, spontaneous press conferences, unrehearsed, and live. Actually quite risky, and now it's presidential practice. He did very well at it, and anyway, in his next press conference, he was asked about this, which had made the news, and he went out of his way to compliment McGeorge Bundy and didn't say anything else on the subject. I learned from a reliable source many years later that the Kennedy Organization was not exactly amused, and behind the president's wit, they could be pretty tough guys. And the Kennedy political organization, they used their contacts, they used family money, they gave priority attention to defeating John Diefenbaker, and they did. He had his own problems, but Lester Pearson, his successor, was much more mainstream, in line with the generally polite, diplomatic, and extremely important and helpful Canadian prime ministers. Canadians have been, as the president indicated, the Canadians have been extremely important allies in modern times, in the 20th century. Until the 20th century, things weren't so good.
And you tell us that even though there obviously is a bit of turbulence in terms of some of the statements that President Trump has made about Canada and so on, you do reassure us, yet existing cooperative structures and practices remain intact. In other words, whatever statements might be made, outrageous or otherwise, that the things that sort of fundamentally connect our two nations are still there and largely in place.
Yes, indeed, and that's an important point to make. And Americans generally don't pay enough attention to our immediate neighbor to the north. And we should all, I guess, thank President Trump for bringing Canada back to the forefront.
To the headlines.
I don't think the Canadians are thanking him much these days, but it is important. And the economic integration in modern times, we can also thank President Lyndon Johnson, reflecting economic and political realities that were developing. An auto pact was signed in 1965. Vietnam War was so ultimately costly in every way, and dominated the Johnson administration increasingly, and the president himself, and I believe eventually destroyed him psychologically as well as politically. A lot went on in the Johnson administration in terms of positive decisions and legislation, and LBJ deserves a lot of credit for the Auto Pact, which opened the door to what is now tight integration between auto manufacturing, auto sales, auto marketing, north and south of the border. If you look at a map, Detroit is very close to the Canadian border, literally. And in those days, the big three were really big. We still dominated the global auto marketplace, and trucks and other vehicles, and motorcycles. The Japanese hadn't really started rolling with their major vehicle offensive, which has changed the nature of the global economy in terms of cars and other vehicles. So Detroit was where was the global center, and opening the door to Canada helped both Canada and us. And NAFTA, which was negotiated by George H.W. Bush, not quite completed, so President Bill Clinton could show up and take the in the limelight and take the credit, which is what he loved to do. A lot of very positive developments followed from the Yalta Pact, and in this area and others, especially civil rights, Lyndon Johnson, not to say Medicare. Someone like me should mention that.
Right.
LBJ deserves a lot of positive credit, which I think eventually he will get.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, I'm spending today's morning show with Dr. Art Sear, and we've been touching on the recent election in Canada in late April that led to a victory by the Liberal Party and Prime Minister Mark Carney. Speaking of agreements, an agreement was very recently forged between the United States and the United Kingdom. And this is something that inspired you to do some reflection on our relationship with the United States, with the United Kingdom, with Great Britain, and also Great Britain's somewhat complicated relationship with the continent of Europe, which, of course, we all know about in terms of Brexit and so on. Tell us more about this trade agreement forged between the U.S. and the United Kingdom and what its ultimate significance is, you think.
Well, I haven't studied it in detail, but the fact that the British, I believe it was, they're the ones that made it possible in terms of really focusing on the details, which are always vexing in any trade agreement. We've agreed, separate from the European Union, both markets for a whole series of identified products and services. Both markets will become more open. I don't think it's revolutionary. The British economy is still, I think, technically the number five economy in the world, but they are separated from the European Union. But I believe for them, they did it as much, if not more, for diplomatic reasons as for economic and commercial reasons. Their history, starting with World War One, not World War Two, their history starting with World War One, starting with the 20th century, has been to develop as close a relationship as possible with the United States and maintain it, rain or shine, hill or high water. And in that sense, given the fact that they are still, in practical terms, very heavily involved with the European Union, the long-term trend has been for British trade to steadily move away from their global commonwealth, what used to be their empire, toward Europe. Brexit was very, very damaging to the economy in Britain. And this is a way both of getting some benefit economically, but also underscoring the fact that psychologically, politically, whatever might be going on in business, the British really feel much more comfortable in the global environment, and especially with North America, the U.S., and please don't forget Canada. The British were instrumental in launching the NATO alliance. Contrast to the European Union, they've been faithful members of NATO from the beginning. They're one of the few countries that actually consistently meet their declared goals for military spending, a topic that Trump has moved to the front burner. And the trade deal, what I'm trying to say, I think, is their trade deal is very much in line with this general approach to strategy.
One thing you said in your column that intrigued me very much is when you said that one of the reasons Britain has been an attractive base for investment by foreign countries is that it has been seen as a way to, in your words, penetrate the more difficult and bureaucratic economic environment of the continent.
Yes.
In other words, you could, by investing in Britain, which was in a sense a little more open, maybe a little more accessible, this could be a potential gateway, at least, to then expand investment onto the European continent itself. I've never heard that observation made before. I find it fascinating.
I believe we've been discussing strong personalities in the White House, for better or worse, and another strong personality, along with President Trump and President Johnson, is Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who was remarkably effective at, in some ways very similar to Johnson, remarkably effective at changing the Conservative Party from one which was relatively comfortable with protectionism and one that was very, very comfortable with the public sector. Conservatives in Britain are very, very different from traditional conservatives in the U.S. pre-Trump. They are not nearly so directly wedded to the free market, the industrial revolution. British conservatism is much more feudal in nature. And she broke apart this rather stodgy emphasis on traditional organizations, large collective entities, public or private, and was so popular with Americans in part because she really was a free market liberal in the free market liberal sense, who was very sympathetic to business and welcomed American, Japanese, and other investment into Britain. It really, starting in 1979, her lengthy regime really greatly brought the British economy out of the doldrums. Canary Wharf, I was fortunate to spend a year in England, in London, when I was a grad student working on a PhD dissertation, and Canary Wharf, the docks were all... Britain was still a rather poor country then. They'd recovered from the war. There was no bomb wreckage visible then. It had all been cleared off, but they were still recovering. And Canary Wharf was a very poor, rundown, working-class area. And it has been transformed. A whole, you know, modern office blocks, high-rise skyscrapers. To me, it symbolizes the kind of modernization and relative prosperity that she made possible. London's still a very expensive place to live, to do business, to have a meal. That was not the case when I was a student, fortunately. But Britain overall is a wealthy country. People who are not millionaires, nightclub owners, investment bankers or gangsters will drive what we would consider a nice car. Back in my student days, everybody was driving a very small car.
Interesting. Those kind of barometers of
exactly.
of economic success.
And, yeah, well, I hope this has been clear. I may be rambling a little more than usual.
No, not at all. I think it's a fascinating story, and it's good to be reminded about Margaret Thatcher, who, of course, ruffled more than a few feathers in the work that she did, and was certainly not a popular figure across the board at all. But there's no question that she dramatically reshaped Britain's profile in the world and its economic standing, especially.
That's a very important point. She was very popular in this country, and she was. In power, contemporary of Ronald Reagan's, and Americans tended to see her as a British version of President Reagan, which was quite false. She was, if anything, we've been discussing LBJ, she was much more comparable to him. She became party leader through her great skill of political maneuvering. She was incredibly hard-working, including twisting arms and intimidating members of parliament, her own cabinet, civil servants. And she was always very, very well briefed. And in their system, that's much more important than in ours, really. And she was a superstar at knowing her material. This anecdote, I generally don't tell them on your program, fortunately, because I think you'd probably not invite me back. But one anecdote, I think, is germane. We're all familiar with the very tiresome alpha male who turns a handshake into a wrestling match. We've met these guys, you know.
Right.
They're not all from Texas, and you never know when you're going to run into one at a meeting or a cocktail party. I was working on the third party, the Liberals, now the Liberal Democrats, and I predicted they would become much more successful. They would become more than just a tiny struggling. People laughed at me, Greg, but I was right, actually. Now the Liberal Democrats doing well. British are very hospitable, and they don't see us as being foreigners. It's really true. And I was a student, so several MPs took me to lunch in the House of Commons cafeteria. And one of them wanted me to meet this rising, very intelligent, very ambitious young MP, Margaret Thatcher. So she was walking near us, and he got up and went over on her and brought her over. And it's the one time I've shaken hands with a woman who turned it into a bone-crunching wrestling match. And I clearly had the impression that she had a glimmer of, she looked rather pleased when my legs buckled, because she took me completely by surprise. And it was still, I was still a kid, you know, basically, so I thought it was kind of a mean thing to do. Well, I wasn't surprised when she achieved ultimate power.
Right. And, formidable in more ways than one.
Yeah, and in that sense, very un-British, and it was because not the Liberals per se, but the Social Democratic Party, now defunct, arose and made an alliance with the Liberals in the 80s, that the Conservatives it split the opposition vote. So Labor, Liberals, Social Democrats divided up the vote, and the Conservatives got a lot of seats in the House of Commons. She was not a popular leader within her own party or within the country, partly for the reasons I've been mentioning.
Right.
Yeah, like President Johnson, up close, she was, of course, a woman and not as unattractive as LBJ, but there was a lot of similarity between the way people were turned off by her eventually.
Interesting. But she got things done,
as did
LBJ.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
We're speaking with Dr. Art Sear on today's morning show. We're going to talk for the next few minutes about President Trump's recent travels to the Mideast. And I think you are right to say that the mainstream media has tended to pay a lot of attention to, in a sense, the wrong things. I mean, some of the glittering trappings of the visit. I think you call it the pageantry of these visits. But you see great significance beyond all of that, beyond gifts of jets and so on. And I think one of the points you make in your column is that it is significant that President Trump has made this trip so early in his term, and also very significant in terms of where he did not go. He went to Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the Arab Emirates,
right?
But he did not visit Israel.
That's right.
Tell us about this. At one point you say, the snub is telling. Tell us more about that.
Well, as most, if not all, of our listeners know, Israel is becoming increasingly isolated thanks to the really brutal and, I believe, unconscionable suppression of the people of Gaza, not just Hamas, but I'm convinced that Netanyahu personally, and he's got a government that's willing to support him, really wants to depopulate Gaza. Given the history of the Jewish people, I will be blunt, although it doesn't always help me out. Given the history of the Jewish people, it's particularly shocking that the government of Israel, the government set up as a Jewish state, in part to recompense the Jewish people for not just several thousand years of persecution, but also the Holocaust just ended. Very courageous move on President Truman. It's a terrible smear on his legacy and the legacy of Americans and others who supported Israel that the Netanyahu government's operating this way. John Mearsheimer, a very intelligent, very insightful, and very respected scholar at the University of Chicago, who has gotten in some trouble for controversial views, has been very public in accusing the government of Israel of genocide in Gaza. I don't think that term applies yet, but I think it's just terrible. It's also kind of productive. I think they're creating a lot of new terrorists by oppressing this basically helpless population and engaging in military strikes that inevitably kill a lot of civilians and trying to move people out of the area. It's not only terribly ironic in an ugly sense, if you know anything about history, but it's not helpful for Israel.
Right.
Netanyahu has a lot of personal reasons, strong, powerful incentives, because he and his wife are under serious criminal indictment. And my sense is, as long as this war goes on, the longer he can delay court proceedings.
His day of reckoning, in a sense.
Yeah. Day of reckoning, right? Day of reckoning, exactly. Yes, you summed it up as usual. As I'm using many words, you have a few words.
I do want to give you a chance to talk about...
So that's my view. Yeah. I hope I'm not too blunt for your...
Sure. So there is that matter of President Trump choosing not to visit Israel at all during a visit to the Middle East, which
that's
is
significant, especially because he's an outspoken supporter of Israel.
Right. You do mention in the same column President Trump's visit with the relatively new leader of Syria.
Yeah.
And I think you do a great job of summing up the chaos that has engulfed that nation in recent years and the relative stability that is in place with their new leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa. You tell us that this is a moment in time in which the United States is perhaps in a position to gain far greater influence in the Middle East than has been recently the case.
Yes.
Explain the shifts in dynamics in that region that make this perhaps an opportunity for the United States.
Syria, the president did not stop in Syria. And
right, you saw him someplace else.
And I'm impressed by the fact that coverage is pretty much overlooked. His meeting with this gentleman is also controversial. Israel has described the new Syria leader as a terrorist in a suit. He has some background with al-Qaeda, and fundamentalist and extremist groups were part of the swirling opposition to the Assad regime that developed in 2011, the so-called Arab Spring, and eventually brought down the long-established Assad government. It was a family business dating, I believe, from about 1970, very strongly affiliated with the Soviet Union. As I mentioned in the column, Russia intervened directly with their own military forces, something historically Russia has not been much inclined to do, but it really symbolized not only the threats the Assad dictatorship was facing, but also the strong affinity that Russia and Putin feels towards Syria. Throughout much of the Cold War, especially after the Suez Crisis of 1956, while the U.S. remained very tightly and closely allied with Syria, with Israel, the Soviet Union steadily expanded influence with the Arab states. With the end of the Cold War, there was an opportunity for us to expand our influence, and I believe George H.W. Bush and his very able Secretary of State and very close colleague, James Baker, did a phenomenal job of mobilizing an international coalition to drive Iraq out of Kuwait. In 1990s, Saddam Hussein very suddenly and arbitrarily invaded Kuwait, one nation invading another. The international coalition, an army of 1 million men led by Norman Schwarzkopf, very quickly achieved victory in early 91, victory being driving Iraq out of Kuwait and then stopping. But Bush and Baker didn't stop. They organized regional diplomacy, and the ultimate Oslo Accords, which were completed, then Bush lost, and then Bill Clinton showed up for the final agreement. But Bush and Baker deserve tremendous credit for this basically comprehensive agreement that included establishing a Palestinian state. Things have come unraveled since that time, as we've been discussing.
Right.
But I believe there is an opportunity. Russia, the Soviet Union, of course, is long gone. Russia is a very weak state. And the United States is just extraordinarily powerful, unprecedented power and unequaled in terms of our global reach and ability to influence events. You mentioned pomp in the Trump delegation. Pomp and plutocracy could also be mentioned, because he took with him a bunch of business, very wealthy businessmen, and including his two sons. And they were busy doing personal deals on the side. At the same time, the president was meeting with the heads of government on this trip. I think it's bad form. It looks bad. And it nonetheless does underscore the very, very great power of the American economy.
Right.
And American capital.
Towards the end of this column, you have a great line when you say, lasting expansion of U.S. influence in the region will depend on disciplined, sustained engagement,
yeah,
a quality not consistently demonstrated by President Trump. So time will tell.
Nor by his predecessors, his immediate predecessors, I might say. So George H.W. Bush was, I believe, a great president, albeit only a one-term president, because of the tremendous dedication and effectiveness and sheer energy he brought to that job.
Yeah,
if he'd had a second term, the Middle East, I'm convinced, would be looking a lot better.
Interesting. Let's finish out.
It's interesting.
Yeah, let's finish out in our last few minutes by turning to a column in which you wrote about Pope Francis. This column was published, I am assuming, shortly after his death and just before the naming of Pope Francis's successor, who, of course, has generated all kinds of headlines, being the first pope from the United States of America, an extraordinary turn of events, Pope Leo. But I want to give you just a couple minutes to talk about Pope Francis and the many things about him that you and others very much admired.
Well, he was very down to earth. He was not from North America, but he was from South America, which I believe was also unprecedented.
You might be right about that, yeah.
The Vatican, I believe, is under economic, speaking of money and economic power, the Vatican reportedly has financial problems, and I believe that's the case. They're a pretty secretive place, to put it politely. So they're casting about for ways to come in to not only the 21st century, but also modern times generally, basically a medieval feudal culture. I'm not Catholic, but it is basically an authoritarian structure. I don't want to offend anyone who's listening. It's also an organization of tremendous importance that does phenomenal goodwill all around the world, especially in the poorest parts of the world and the poorest parts of the United States. However, it is, I think, an effort to try to modernize the Catholic Church and to symbolize the fact that it's not just a bunch of secretive old men doing mysterious things in Rome. Mind you, probably all our listeners know that the Vatican is a very popular source for conspiracy and intrigue stories. There are more than one or two novelists and also screenwriters and producers who've gotten richer through writing or producing conspiracy stories about the Vatican. Francis was unpretentious, down to earth. He was not buried in the Vatican. He was buried, which is quite a departure, buried outside the church. And he did preach tolerance in a way that marks change in the Catholic Church.
Right. And I appreciated the point you made that, in certain things that he did, for instance, certain letters he drafted or whatever, that sometimes what would grab the headlines was something that seemed to be very tradition-bound on the surface, but that often beneath the surface, as you say, Pope Francis was sharing a message, preaching a message of tolerance and compassion, and of understanding to even to those that do not embrace Catholic doctrine and so on. I mean, a quiet, gentle revolutionary in many respects. I want to give you a chance to talk about this new Pope, Pope Leo. How amazed and surprised were you to see an American, that is a USA American man elected Pope?
Quite surprised, like everybody else. I certainly didn't expect it, and absolutely did not predict it. And he's from Chicago. He's not from a more he's not from a more traditional environment on the East Coast. In earlier times, one might have expected him to come from the Boston-New York axis, or the Boston-New York-Philadelphia-Washington axis. No, it's quite a gesture. I don't know a great deal about him. I do know he's spent a good part of his career in Latin America, if not almost all of it.
Right,
doing
in Peru,
the same
I believe,
kind of
yes.
good works that, yes, Pope Francis did. And Latin America is a part of the world. It's not been among the poorest parts of the world for a long, long time. Better off than a good part of Africa and Asia historically, but politically undemocratic, authoritarian. There are people who say that it's a way of trying to compensate for Trump, but I think that's the mainstream media and their obsessions and manias at work. And I doubt that the Catholic hierarchy in Rome operates that way. I think they're interested in symbolizing change and also reinforcing their involvement with parts of the world that are growing, parts of the world that are changing. Latin America has gone from almost universally dictatorships to almost universally representative governments in the last four decades or so. That's a phenomenal change. And I think perhaps strategically they're focusing more on the Americas. The church is growing very, very rapidly, of course, elsewhere in Africa. But it remains strongly entrenched in Latin America and surely a very powerful institution in the United States.
Absolutely.
So I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud because none of us really knows.
Sure.
But I think that makes sense.
Right.
And he, in terms of temperament and approach, he's Pope Leo seems like a very modern individual. Mind you, the media is focused on the fact that concerning current public topics of great interest, gay rights and others, he seems to be more traditional than Francis. We'll see. I certainly would not judge the new pope by media speculation in any way.
That's probably a very good idea.
Yeah, and including media that's closely tied to the Catholic Church, of course. Let's see how he operates.
Right, and see what he does.
There is, I have heard him interviewed, and he's very American. He's very down to earth, and he comes across as a regular guy, as did Pope Francis.
Right.
Correcting for culture.
Sure.
But I think that'll be very good for the image that a lot of people have of the Catholic Church.
And on that note, on that hopeful note, we finish out this conversation with you, Dr. Art Sear, a frequent guest to the morning show, essentially a monthly guest for more than two decades. And I've enjoyed each and every one of these visits and look forward to future visits and appreciate the time you gave us today on the morning show. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope I was clear.
Absolutely.
Good. Thanks. No, we just finished finals at the college, and I took a fall, and Yeah, I'm glad I was clear on the air.
Absolutely. Okay. And we wish you well and look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
Well, I'll be back, Greg.
We have weather in our southeastern Wisconsin that is cloudy and rainy with a high in the mid-50s. Clouds tomorrow, but then sunshine over the weekend. This is W.